carrying it over.
And I was in the kitchen, I was thinking about the value of retreats, because they become something of a trend in the devotee community, and really everywhere you look. I'm sure none of you are immune from social media feeds filled with opportunities to retreat. And one of my teachers some time ago said, what are people retreating from? They're already scared and hiding. They're already living lives that are like very hoveled, so where are they retreating to from their retreat? So there's something, as with everything in this world, retreats can become their own kind of toxic escape, their own kind of awkward attempt at upliftment that really is just another quick fix, and not letting something happen profound. And I was thinking, as we were cooking, mostly I was cooking.
Me and Super Soul.
Yeah, me and Super Soul. And all of you that I have conversations with in my head when you're not there.
All the voices.
And all the people dropping into the kitchen. And
absentee devotees.
The plural we, as the dudes used to say. There's two experiences of retreat that I've had myself that I see happening here, at least, and maybe there are more. But one that I personally see myself moving into and excited about for this weekend is that this retreat is not really a break from my normal life, in the sense that it's very much where I spend my normal life with many of the people that I spend that time with, a few added exceptions, very welcome exceptions. What the retreat from is the normal pace of that life. And the next few days for me and maybe others is an opportunity to enter deeply into space that we don't get to spend together, time that we don't get to invest. Not because we don't want to, but because the pace of everyday life doesn't let us. And that's what I am really looking forward to this weekend myself, is getting that quality time with people that I love dearly and who are around me all the time, that I don't always get to take the time to be with the ways I would like. And in that way, it's a retreat from the normality of that keeps us away so often. And then there's another element of really leaving your comfort zone, getting out of the place where you do your everyday and going in with people even that you may not be so familiar with, and connecting and recognizing that potential of human and spiritual existence in everybody that can happen like that. People you've never known, and in seconds you feel like you've spent lifetimes with them in a beautiful way. And thankfully we have a cohort from DC here who came up, and a few other faces which we don't always see all the time. Brajaraj Gopal, all the way up from Atlanta. Of course, Maharaj Jai Jagannath, guests that we always, honorary members of the community who somehow or other often spend most of their time physically away. So that new, that's mixed in Bhakti Rasa as well, also up for the first time, but hopefully not the last time. That new that's mixed in creates enough of a contrast in our immediate space to kind of remind us all, oh yeah, something different is supposed to happen. Something is supposed to be special. And that's really every day. And that's where I see the value of retreating, is to be able to return on Tuesday to the spaces where we normally inhabit with the people that we normally engage with, and to be able to approach them in a way that is more profound, more connected, more aware of the beauty that's potentially always there, but so often I'm tuned out from for a variety of reasons. And so I welcome all of you. You know, sometimes there'll be people sitting on this side of the line, so to speak, and talking and sharing something. But you guys are as important, as valuable, as wanted in terms of a contribution to this semicircle, which we're just going to call a circle because no one wants to be in a semicircle. So it is physically a semicircle, but metaphorically, and hopefully felt as a circle, that we're all now entering into and to recognize and be aware of both what I want to get from that circle as well as what I want to give, what I want to contribute. So our radical personalism framing, welcome to the circle, Shari. Our framing for this retreat is reclaiming our ideals. And to my sharing of where I'm coming into and considering this retreat as really a continuation of things that are already going on in my life and allowing that to happen in somewhat of a more exciting context, a few of us were together only a few weeks ago, and particularly myself, Maharaj, and Ujjwal were sharing a yurt, something like this, but canvas instead of pine. And
colder.
And generally colder. Generally colder. It did get warm in the yurt also, but that first night was chilly.
First night.
First night was chilly. And we got to talking and we got to churning as it goes, and something came out around simple ideas that are also foundational to the culture of any spiritual community, and particularly our Gaudiya Vaishnava community, and how those words that represent those ideals can very often become hackneyed. They can become so commonplace that they lose their potency. I've heard it. I've understood it. I am it. Those ideas start to settle in, or they're it over there and over here, or we or not that. And when those ideas start to settle in and we become kind of indifferent to those words that represent those hopes and possibilities, spiritual life becomes stagnant. And we lose taste, we lose excitement, we lose vigor. On the other side, when those simple ideas and words feel like a great opportunity, then every moment feels like an opportunity to meet them. And so we got to talking and churning about the idea of reclaiming our ideals, recognizing their value, churning it for each other and for ourselves, and thus here we all find ourselves this evening with that framing as how we want to contextualize the conversation over the next 4 days. Well, myself, Maharaj, Jai are going to guide a panel tonight, so we'll each share something around this kind of core idea of reclaiming our ideals, what it means for us, so to speak, where we're approaching it from, and then we welcome it from you all, questions, reflections, comments, conversation in the circle. Then tomorrow morning, Maharaj will lead a session, share for about 45 minutes to an hour, and then again, opening it up to the circle. Same for Jai in the evening on Saturday, and then Sunday morning we're going to have Ujjwal Prabhu guide a similar session, Maharaj Sunday night, and then coming back together again Monday for our final panel circle. And there'll be swimming in between, there'll be prasad in between, there'll be cow cuddles in between, maybe some frisbee will break out. It was Shari's idea to have this gathering here in this space. We were thinking about other places to go, and she's like, well, we have our own land. And it's nice out there, and Yashoda's there, and it's very true that we have been blessed in this community by Krishna to be able to take care, to steward a little corner of Mother Bhumi and try to accentuate her beauty and thank her for all the service that she does everywhere else, our little place to say thank you and try to take care of her. And so we've done an okay job of that as a community, but we could do much better. And one of the ways is to be on the land together and to feel the work that's already gone on and the work that could go on to help it be even more of a space that people come to and immediately feel, grace, love, beauty, nature, connection. So thank you, Shari, for inviting us all here. And as you're here, whether you're camping or you're coming back and forth, don't forget that part of the retreat also, to be on the land and to be with the land. We've charted a path around so you can walk. There's a very cute little grove of cottonwoods back there. There's a very charming wheat field that's not ours, but it's fun to stand on the ocean of the shore of wheat and look across at the beautiful glade of trees. And you can go into the cow pastures, none of the cows are going to hurt you. The ones that would are terrified of you, so that they'll leave you alone. And Yashoda, especially, who's the beautiful brown cow, she's very friendly and very approachable. So if you don't know how to approach cows, talk to somebody. We'll be happy to help you do that. Otherwise, approach her just like you would any other cow. Hands out, let her take a sniff first, and then scratch behind the neck.
You can offer obeisances too.
You can offer obeisances.
That's the essence of
certainly.
Cow service.
She'll be happy to see you, and you'll definitely be happy to see her. So be with the land also during the retreat. Let that be part of your break from your normal here at Goloka Premadham. So with that, I'll hand it to Maharaj and
let me record.
I'm recording with you. You can call.
Yes, recording is already happening. So.
I'll go. So that I'll be forgotten by then. I didn't know I was going to be here as like a panelist or doing anything. I actually had no plan to come here this time.
Oh, come on.
Seriously. But Padmanabha Maharaj told me in Arkansas that, hey, I'm doing the retreat this time. I said, oh, great, I'll come and participate in the retreat.
This is participation.
So I didn't.
It's a bait and switch.
Oh, it's a bait and switch. I'll keep that
classic
in mind.
Yeah, it's all about reframing the words.
So the topic is reclaiming our ideals. You know, the first thing that came up for me was Brahma at the beginning of creation performing tapasya in order to have darshan the Lord. So according to how you do your practice, then you'll get a certain darshan of God. So in the nature, Krishna says, in accordance with the nature of your approach, I will reciprocate in kind. So if you approach God as Brahman, he will reciprocate to you as impersonal Brahman. If you approach God as an enemy, he will remove your head happily. If you approach God as friend or lover, he becomes a friend or beloved. So one nice verse is there, Twam Bhakti Yoga Pari Bhavite Hrisaroja Ase Shrutekshita Pata Nananata Pongsam. Very beautiful verse. First part of the verse says, the Lord comes and takes his seat in the heart that is infused with divine love. Bhakti Yoga Pari Bhavite Hrisaroja Ase. He will take the seat in the heart of one whose heart is infused with love. How did he get a heart that is infused with love? That question comes. Shruti Ikshitapata, by the path of first hearing about love, and then after that seeing. Shruti Ikshitapata. Prabhupada translates this as the path of seeing through hearing, or seeing through the ears, that's how he translates it. But it means first you hear about the ideal of love, let's say in this context, and then you, inspired by the hearing, you take up some search for love, and then you see it. Shruta Ikshitapata, so the path of first hearing, then seeing. So what type of God you see? Ya yadhiya ta urugaya vibhavayanti tat tat bapur pananyase saranugrahaya. Ya yadhiya means according to your meditation. Ya yadhiya tat tat bapur, then the Lord will manifest that form. I actually had genuine concern about this when I was new bhakta, that if you meditate on Krishna, will Varahadev show up? No, the form of the Lord that is part of your inner world constantly, that form of the Lord will manifest to show mercy to the devotee. So there should be coherence there. So as an example of this particular verse, Jiva Goswami gives Brahma at the beginning of creation as an example of a person who saw God according to his devotions, according to his inner meditation. He got a darshan of God. So this is reported in the beginning of the 9th chapter of the 2nd canto. So he first gets a darshan. He performs tapasya. You know the story. I'm not telling all the details. But he performs the austerity, and then he gets a darshan of Vaikuntha. And then after the darshan of Vaikuntha, the Supreme Lord appears before him. We come to hear that the Supreme Lord is Swayam Bhagavan Sri Krishna. And then he shakes hands with Brahma, apparently.
Good luck, Brahma.
Good job.
Good luck.
He shakes hands with Lord Brahma. And then he begins to give him the Srimad Bhagavatam, essence in four verses. So the four verses is actually seven verses total. Two verses introduce the Chatushloki, and then one verse concludes it. But in the middle, he gives four verses. That is the essence of Srimad Bhagavatam in four verses. So in the first introductory verse, Krishna says he will talk four topics. The topic of Gyan, Vigyan, Rahasya, and Tat Anga. These are the four topics of the Chatushloki verses. So Gyan means knowledge about God, essentially, in short. Vigyan is knowledge about Maya, because Maya is what is preventing us from having realization of divinity, even though we hear a lot, but we don't experience. So why we don't experience? Because we are in Maya. Yaya samohita jiva atmanam trigunatmakam paropi manyate anartam takritam chabipatite. This verse is telling, because of being bewildered by Maya, the jiva, who is transcendental, thinks himself as a product of Maya. And this thinking is anartam. This is the anartha. Just like sometimes we say we have anartha lust, envy, greed, or we have anartha like smoke cigarettes or other stuff, anartha. But this is the main anartha, that we think ourselves are product of Maya, even though we're not. And after that, all the fun begins. After that anartha, then the fun starts. So because of this Maya, we're not seeing. So the topic of Vigyan, realization of God, that is the first topic, Gyan, can only happen if we shake off the Maya. So this is the topic of the second verse of Chatushloki. Then if you shake off the Maya, you'll experience the goal. The goal is called as Rahasya, the secret. The Rahasya means the secret, and this secret is disclosed as divine love, Jiva Goswami. It's supposed to be our ideal divine love. And then he says the fourth topic is Tat Anga. So Tat Anga means an Anga, like a limb of that secret. Just like your arm is a limb of your body. So Tat Anga means a limb of the body of the secret. So if the body of the secret is love, then the limb of that body is called the Tat Anga. So the limb that will lead to that divine love is called Sarana. Basically, it is a verse about sadhana. Now, what I like about this verse is that when Krishna gives the verse for what is tad anga, he says, etavan eva jignasam, tato jignasunatmana, is that the verse?
Yeah.
Etavan eva jignasam means for those who are interested in realizing the truth of the self, God, basically, essentially, then they must certainly inquire up to this point. Mm-hmm. Etavan eva jignasam. So this means they must certainly inquire up to the point of praying, up to the point of actually embodying the secret. They should inquire up to, and until you've actually embodied that, then your inquiry or investigation work is not complete. So this is sadhana. So sadhana is kind of described here as a process of inquiry. So most of us, we think of sadhana as a process of like hearing, chanting, remembering, etc., etc. But as we were saying, I have this experience. I wonder if this experience is true for others also. That before we became devotees, we had a more sincere inquiry spirit than after we became devotees. Do you recall that? Do you recall when you were like passionately inquiring about like God and divinity? That's the point when you were like totally ignorant. Maybe that is still standing. But you know, totally ignorant, but a little bit less now. But there was a time where it was like 100%, like 100% ignorance. Now it might be like 98%, but I had 2% progress in it. This time I was 100% ignorant, but I had like a very intense inquiry spirit that eventually led me to embrace Krishna consciousness. Anyone remember that when you were like, and then you come to the process, you hear and you come to learn like doctrine. You learn to learn like protocol and like a certain ethic of being in certain spaces. And basically you learn a status quo, not only in terms of behavior, but also in terms of understanding. And once you embrace a doctrine, it like kills the inquiry spirit. Have you also recognized this?
Yes.
So you come to the sanghas, you come to the classes, and you know all the points. I've heard this a million times. I already know what Gyan Vigyan Rahasya Tattva means. Of course, you're polite, so you don't do it outside, but inside you're doing. Isn't it? It is like this. So what happened to that passionate, inquisitive person that was allowed to break through into the life of spirit? Now we're just like this passionless, ferventless, you know, muh.
Listless, muh.
Right? Just a muh. And so basically the basic idea is that spiritual progress stops where inquiry stops. That's what I'm trying to say. Where inquiry has stopped, then there you will take your rest. And if it is a listless place, then that will be where you stay until you can again find the inquiry spirit that will allow you to penetrate further and deeper. That's what I meant to say. I've been saying this thing a lot for this year, so I guess it's something I need to hear also. But the word question and quest, they kind of share a similar etymology. So every question, in one sense, implies a quest. Every question implies a quest that will give the revelation to the question that you're being asked. If questions are happening inside of us, then the quest of what has to happen outside for there to be revelation to the answer. And just like the eye has a potential to see, but it cannot see without the assistance of the sun. The sun is what activates its potential of sight. Otherwise, you cannot see anything. So the questions are like an eye. It has a potential for a certain revelation. Because every question is connected to a certain like revelatory fruit. Every question, if a question is like, I don't know, what's a good example? If a question is like a seed, it's connecting to a certain fruiting body of that seed. So it has a potential to give that fruit. You're asking that question has a potential to give that fruit. But you need the assistance of the sun and the rain, etc., in order for that to fructify. So what is the sun? That is the quest. The quest that you go on to get the revelation to that question, that is like the sun and the rain that nourishes the question and allows for the seed to unfold. So what I've observed personally, and I think this is true also for others, is that when we were newer, we were prepared to take the quest to the questions that we were asking. In my particular case, I often tell my story where, for me, it was a question about the reality of romantic love. I wanted to understand that. I came in contact with Signs of Civilization. Prabhupada said, romantic love in the material world is nonsense. And then he says the thing about you can have romance with God. I was like, what? That's like, it's for real. And so I took a certain quest to understand, to have further revelation. I joined the Hare Krishna movement. I left aside my whole prospect with dance world, and I joined the Hare Krishna movement as the quest that was implied in the question that I was asking. Mm-hmm. And then I got a certain fruit. But now I've lived in that sort of space for so long, and then it's like hackneyed, you know. Now I've got certain answers. I think that I know things. So how can I progress further from here? But we have to rediscover the inquiry spirit that allows for further breakthrough. So this is the hardest thing for spiritual practitioners after they've accepted some dogma, after they've accepted that they know, as if they have knowledge in the palm of their hands. God is infinite and a great mystery, but we feel that, like Prabhupada has also said, we know his address, we know his phone number. You know, he would flex like this on the reporters. Do you know, we know everything about God. That is okay. We also, when you want to flex, you have to show yourself a little bit big. But actually the truth of the matter is God is ananta. He is infinite. No one can hold in the palm of the hands. That is not possible. So there are always further progress needed to be made. That can only happen with the strength of inquiry. So the way that I kind of received the topic, reclaiming your ideals, I kind of heard it as like a rediscovery of ideal. What is my ideal? So I had a question, it led to a certain fruit, and that fruit became my ideal. But now as I held the fruit for too long, I've maybe lost appreciation of it, I've lost the sense of its exquisiteness. And so now I have to go on another journey of rediscovering. Huh? Just like baseball, this baseball analogy works really well, I promise. But just like baseball, you start at home and you go in a circle and come back to home with a point earned. You don't get a point by staying at home base. Mm-hmm. You get a point by leaving home base and then a return to home. So I feel like spiritual life is something like this. You had the quest in the beginning, the question. You went on a certain quest. It gave a fruit. That fruit became your ideal. Now it has become familiar, hackneyed for whatever reason. And so now you have to go on the journey of return. The journey of return is like archetypal. You know, it happens in life constantly. Mm-hmm. Whether you're talking about a return to who you are, a return to your ideals, it's archetypal in nature. Somehow Maya has covered your sense of the exquisiteness and the immaculate nature of your ideal. So now you have to go on a journey of return. The journey of return. If you stay at home base, you don't get any point. But if you leave from home and to return to home, then you get a point. You get something earned. So the thing about journeys after you've embraced a doctrine is that you don't take voluntarily usually. Because you already feel at home. To some degree, you know, home, as a person who travels to many different homes, home is rough. Like home life, once you get kind of comfortable in the home, then you know, maybe it's not the most dynamic life, but it's comfortable. So I'll stay here, right? This is why Prahlad Maharaj is saying these real heavy things like Hitvatma Patam Griha Andukupan. He says heavy things like this because the home is like this. You get so comfortable that it becomes like a fetter that you don't move. And I'm not just talking about external movement, I'm talking about inner movement also. You don't move, it's just comfortable life. So that we all have this problem. So unless we are compelled by, you know, great spirit, by something mysterious that interject into that, then it's hard to leave from home to rediscover those ideals. So Krishna may make some trick. Oh, you are Parikshit Maharaj? You already nicely situated. But you know what? Put that dead snake on homeboy. You know, in the Bhagavatam, when you encounter the story, no, it is like this. This is a story. This is, in fact, a story. It was not told so clearly in Bhagavatam. I'm telling clearly. Bhagavatam doesn't tell clearly. I'm telling it clearly. In the Bhagavatam, when this story is unfolded, the first thing we learn about Parikshit Maharaj is that he's completely sober, dhira, and not disturbed by the material senses. The Bhagavatam first tells us that, and right after telling us that, he got disturbed by hunger and thirst. Wait, what's going on? You just said homeboy is beyond this. Right after telling us this, he gets disturbed by hunger and thirst. Then he puts the snake on homeboy. Then after he does it, he's like, what have I done? He also was confused. What have I done? It is like this verse, Aham Veti Shukho Veti Vyasa Veti Naveti Va Bhaktya Bhagavatam Graham Na, what is it? Na Buddhaya Chatikaya, I think. Some of these verses like this. This verse is saying, this is spoken by Lord Shiva. He says, I know Srimad Bhagavatam. Shukadeva Goswami, he also knows Srimad Bhagavatam. Vyasa may know Bhagavatam, he may not know. How he can know or not know? He wrote the Bhagavatam. How can he not know the Bhagavatam? And so Srila Sridhar Maharaj, Prabhupada's godbrother, he said because Vyasa is just a conduit. So divinity just coming through him. So he also becomes astonished by what's coming out. That's the answer he gives. So something like this with Parikshit Maharaj. He didn't know what he was doing. After he does it, he goes home and says, what's going on? What have I done? So I'm telling clearly what happened. Krishna was like, put that snake on, boy. Bhagavatam left that part out. So I'm telling clearly now. He got inspired by some mysterious force to do it. That's what I'm saying. That's the point I'm making. And then he had to leave from home, so to speak, and go on his journey of return. And it's very beautiful. Then the Bhagavatam gets manifest and so on. The story goes on. So that's what I'm saying. You have to go on. Krishna as a very mysterious force has to enter into your life in the form of questions that vex your spirit and force you on the journey of return. So what that generally tends to look like is, or what it may look like, it can look like anything actually, but what I'm kind of coming to appreciate in our Sangha, what it can tend to look like is like disaffection from all the people and ideals that you were accustomed to. It can look like feeling alienated. Like, oh, are these even my people? And people practically do it also. They alienate. They live in communities, they don't come. So that's probably because some serious force is now pushing their hand. Now you have to go on a journey of return. Or sometimes they draw the circle like this, like a descent thing. You kind of like fall away a little bit so that you can burn. Those questions can burn and vex your spirit so that you, again, are reinvigorated by that burning sensation to like really inquire in truth and go on a quest. So this is how I'm kind of receiving the return to our ideals thing, or reclaiming our ideals. First, the basic elements is that you need questions. The inquiry and the quest implied, that is the main thing. Because that thing is rarely comes by our own inspiration. So God working in your life will come in the way that it comes up for you. Are these my people? Is this my philosophy? Is God a person? Do I believe in a personal God? All these questions I just said, I've heard from my friends in the last 6 months. All these questions. Is this my philosophy? Am I an impersonalist? Now they're all on their journeys of return, basically. So these are basic elements that maybe I'll try to unfold the best I can. Maybe all I did was, this is all I can do for the rest of the retreat. So I apologize. But I think it would be a cool exercise, maybe when I get to do my thing tomorrow, that we kind of like trace out the sort of questions that got us to make progress, and we examine where that space is now. I think some of you for sure are already having those burning questions in you, and it's like moving, and it's like disturbing the spirit. You know, it's like moving, isn't it? It's like moving around like this, all over the body, disturbing the spirit. You know, and it looks like putting the bee back down. You're like, let me go and chat Japa. We don't know if we believe in that. It does. It's moving. It's disturbing. You have to take the quest to see where that's going, so that you can see what is your ideal. You're also rediscovering it for yourself. That's how I'm hearing this topic. So I'll try to unpack these sorts of things in the course of my time here. Sorry for speaking so much, but this came out. I did Mongol Charan at the beginning.
He has a sannyasi next to him. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Check the boxes just. Wow. In one sense, the blessing and the curse, if you will, of talking at the end of these two giants, so to say, it's like in one sense that all that I was thinking about sharing is completely shattered now. I just want to talk about what they talked about. So that's a blessing. Ultimately, there is no curse at all. But so I'd like just to share a few words in terms of what came from Deva Madhava and Jay Jagan. There's so much to unpack there. Incredible. Where to start? I really appreciated what both of you said, and again, I didn't know this was radical personalism part two, but I'm totally in for that, because for me, radical personalism, which of course, as you may know, I wrote a book with that name, but at the end of the book, I mentioned, for me, this is an ongoing conversation, so this is not like, okay, this is the last word about the whatever that means, and over. Oh, this is just like a kickstart, and there we are forever, because the nature of these topics is ever evolving. Mm-hmm. We can never stop talking about this, stop reflecting, stop inquiring, because the nature of the subject matter is infinity itself. So the very moment that we establish some closure to the topic, that shows how far we are from the topic. Mm-hmm. And as Jai was mentioning very accurately, many times we have this, and that I remember that was the main point that Deva Madhava Prabhu mentioned in a few weeks ago when we were starting to like milk the ideas for the retreat together. I think I'll ask you, what would you like for us to talk about? Something that, in regarding to continually keeping our spirit of students forever and always learning and always open to wonder and always remaining in that space of inquiry, passionate inquiry. So now Jai is quoting, of course, this beautiful verse from the Bhagavatam, talking about inquiry, sarvatra, sarvada, also that verse says, in every place, in every direction, it sounds like a little bit neurotic, but actually it's showing the Parikshit means that, basically, right? Parikshit is the main core figure of the Bhagavatam, and that means he has his eyes in every possible direction, inquiring, the inquirer, basically. He's like the archetypal figure of the inquirer. And we are supposed to become that also, right? It's not just, okay, he has 7 days to live, how will I figure out if I have 7 days to live? It's not so much from that place, but more from which place he's presenting his inquiry. And this last month, I started to study the Bhagavatam again, and again, there's Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya, no end again. And something that really struck me, I'm just on the third canto now, but I found like every time that a new session of the Bhagavatam begins, whether it is Parikshit, Sukadev, Sutta Goswami, sages of Naimisharanya, Krishna, Brahman, Narada, Vyasa, all of the sessions, mostly Maitreya, Vidura, some inquiry is presented, and then before the answer comes the glorification of the inquiry from the speaker. And many verses say that the speaker became infused by those questions. And he, at one point, he said, Pratipuja. He kind of honored and worshipped the questions. And for me, it's not so much, okay, you presented a very smart inquiry. Congratulations. But it's more like honoring this spirit of desire. Openness and disclosure and students forever. And the Bhagavatam is establishing that particular point every single session. Again, we have to have the eyes to see those things repeating themselves over and over again. And I happen to be writing now another book after Radical Personalism, and interestingly the book is quite connected to what we are talking, because it deals with the idea that in one sense everything is ever evolving, right? So the nature of divine love is in constant growth and expansion. Therefore, Krishna, who is God in love, or love himself, Raso Vaisaha, he is Rasa, he is love. He's ever evolving. He's not a fixed substance that we someday can bring to closure, define fully, put all the corresponding labels, and okay, I have Krishna in my pocket. He's on the move. So love is on the move, Krishna is on the move. Our potential in connection to them must be on the move. Cannot be like a fixed point of certainty. Like Jai was mentioning in the beginning, we have this passionate inquiry, spirit of inquiry, and then statu quo started to show up, dogma started to appear, all the correct answer, what to do, what not to do, the do's and don'ts were given to us. So I'm a pure devotee, I'm chanting my 16 rounds, following the four regs, Goloka, there we go, in this lifetime. Something like that. And we develop this false sense of, toxic sense of certainty, I will say. And as we talk, I remember our last retreat, we actually define faith in the exact opposite way. Faith, the opposite of faith is certainty. And generally say, the opposite of faith is doubt. No. The opposite of faith is certainty. Doubt has a big, powerful role in nourishing faith. Inquiry, passionate inquiry means I have doubts, I have questions, and there's place for them to nourish my faith journey. So the faith journey doesn't mean I'm advancing in Krishna Bhakti means I have more and more answers and more certainties. Probably not. you have more and more certainties in a substantial sense, but that brings forth new questions. Not that you are doubting the integrity of the path, but you have questions about how to honor the integrity of the path that is so certain. And those questions will remain probably forever in different degrees. It's not that in the spiritual world there are no questions of another type, but there are questions. There's inquiry, there's passionate inquiry. probably the at that point is the inquiry is, where is Krishna? I'm just dying in separation. How can I bring Radha and Krishna together? That's, but still there's some inquiry, and that's very passionate, I must tell you. So, but we will reach the ultimate realm of passionate inquiry being on some way passionate ourselves in our inquiry. Because, again, as Jai was mentioning very nicely with the word statu quo, and the other day I was reading a book from a friend of mine. She's a Franciscan nun, theologian and scientist, very interesting person, and she would say, God is more interested in adventure than in preserving the statu quo. I was like, okay. God is more interested in adventure than he is in preserving the statu quo. He comes to disrupt the statu quo, if you are sincere. And that's how I understand what Krishna will say, jasyaham anugrihinami, and so on and so forth. It's not so much like, I will take all your bank account that you will end up with your pregnant wife under a tree. No. He's saying, I will disrupt you in a sacred way. You need sacred disruptions. So I will bring that if you're open to that. So, and one of the names of Krishna is Urukrama, as we were talking the other day. Urukrama, which means the great adventurer. He who makes very bold steps. Urukrama. Urukrama.
Urukrama.
Krama means like steps, no? And Uru means like bold, big steps. No? He likes adventure. So that's our God, no? Just for you to know. We want to relate with someone who is the king of adventure. So you cannot go with him with a golden plate of statu quo. No. I'm begging, please be less adventurous, please. No. This is disrupting my comfort, my home. And Krishna said, no, that's not home. No, that's not home. That's not the home I want you to. As Jai was very beautifully depicting the hero's journey in baseball-like terms, I appreciated the cultural sensibility here in the U.S. If you come to South America, you have to find some other example. Nobody knows what baseball is there. We'll find
some. You have to cross the center line to get to the goal.
Yeah. We'll find some. But yeah, I totally appreciate this archetype that is found in any tradition of departure from the familiar and initiation into the mystery and the return with your gift as a transformed person. And for me, going back to what Dev Mahaprabhu was saying also in terms of what a retreat for. For me, a retreat in one sense is part of that journey. Kind of, we were at home a few hours ago, now we are coming outside of the familiar. It starts to become maybe unsettling, especially for the weird things that these three guys are saying. but it's part of the experience of rediscovery. And eventually we will return home, hopefully, transform. I mean, if we are open, we have to have this unconditional faith that there will be transformation. There cannot not be, because that's the nature of sincere gathering. There is so much empowering there. So Deva Ma was talking about retreat, and for me also retreat, I was hearing him and thinking, sometimes I give this example with the notion of detachment, because sometimes we take detachment as indifference, or like refusal, rejection, but no, detachment is just take enough distance from something so we can understand that from what it is and you can return to it with transformed vision. It's not so much like detachment, that's bad. No, that's evasiveness, spiritual bypassing, and cowardice, you say, like just running away from stuff, as Deva Ma was saying. You know, we are hiding and running so much, so more retreats for running further. So the idea of a retreat is just, I'm taking enough distance from whatever so I can understand that for what I can zoom out and get the bigger picture and put my situation in context of a bigger picture, because sometimes I'm too much like enmeshed and entangled in the daily pace and dynamics that I lose sight that this is happening in a context of a bigger picture and a bigger picture. So the zooming out, for me, a retreat is kind of that. I'll zoom out, go deep, immerse yourself in certain particular fire. As Brahma did, tapas means fire. That's the first word of creation. Interesting. Fire. That sets the tone for the whole cosmic unfolding. Welcome to the show.
Just a little hint.
Yeah. This is all about fire. Brahma, he heard fire, what he did, he closed his eyes and did introspection, basically. That's what fire meant to him, interestingly, right? So, tapas, you know, self-study. You know? Interestingly, in our tradition, Jai was quoting Shastra, and we are talking about, sometimes we go to Shastra and educate ourselves and feel inspiration and clarity, but sometimes the word for scriptural study is Swadhyaya. Swadhyaya. And Swadhyaya, technically speaking, means meditating on yourself. Swadhyaya. In other words, it's introspection. So that's the actual purpose of open the book. It has to, whatever content is there has to be reflected in a way that takes you to a certain fire. And again, this fire is outside of the familiar. It's part of leaving the known land and entering the mystery. You were talking about Prem as Rahasya. No? And in order to attain that Parama Rahasya, Parama Guhyam, that is love, we have to start to inhabit some form of mystery, some form of unknown. We have to start to develop some taste to coexist with what we cannot grasp and control and fully understand. So, and again, that for me has to do with keeping this spirit of being a student and having questions and saying, I don't know. I'm being okay with that. No, we are not here to bring closure, but to promote disclosure. No. Too much closure becomes like suffocating. No? It's like you can become an addiction. You can become a certainty junkie, so to say. No, let's bring closure to everything. No, all the answers, everything is clear, everything is in place, all in order. No, no more chaos to disrupt the structure. But if you have an overdose of order and closure, that starts to resemble a totalitarian regime, basically. Dictatorship. Everything in place, and whatever disrupts the system, kill it. So that's not what we want. We want a balance of, as we will be talking, and probably which Prabhupada will share something these days, and this bipolarity that we need to invoke. Not only one unipolarity, not only one way of doing things, but break the normal and disrupt in a sacred way. So, yeah, some thoughts that came to my mind in connection to reclaiming our ideals, just what comes to my mind, the word, for me the word reclaiming is very, sounds like very empowering to me. It's kind of the opposite of something disempowering, no? Like reclaiming, no? Recovering. Not something that is lost, it's not something that you lost all your ideals, so you're coming to this retreat and we'll give you back to you, then back to you. It's not about that. It's just in case I'm clarifying. Don't come with over expectations, over idealization. But this is even better, which is the nature of the ideals are such that you can always reclaim them because there's so much to continue draw from them. That's the daily reclaiming. That's the daily renewal and rediscovery. The nature of the ideals we have received are of such nature. That you can never stop reclaiming them. They can always, you can always own them more and more. No, it's like the other day, Nrisimha Chaturdasi was coincided with my sannyas anniversary, whatever that means, but 15 years of that. And I was thinking that day, like, okay, I accepted sannyas when I was 28. Not the most recommended age, just in case. Somehow I survived, here I am. But I would think I was a very different person 15 years ago. I was a different person last year, or to speak, 15 years ago. I took sannyas from a very different place than from the place I'm continuing to as a sannyasi. Mm-hmm. So my point is, I continue renewing my vows on a yearly basis, weekly basis, daily basis. So in the same way that not only me as a sannyasi, but each of us have our own vows and commitments, have to renew our vows for them to remain relevant and real and alive. For me, reclaiming our ideals is something like that. Reclaim your ideas, renew your vows, you know, like renew your commitment. But from a natural way, you know, like renew your commitment, you know, sign here, align with the affiliate with, yeah, exactly.
Let's do.
But what we have a commitment, you know, as I like to say, we have a commitment to our potential. I like to put it that way. We have a potential, we didn't know we had such a bright potential, we get to know something like Krishna consciousness, and we are informed about the beautiful potential of the soul in transcendence and That's such an astonishing idea. So we receive that information and that prospect of transformation. So that's our potential. Now that I know that potential, I have a commitment to that potential. Not to go neurotic, like, I'm not there yet, I'm not there yet. Because again, the potential is ever evolving. So in one sense, you will never be there. That for me is also an important point. It's not like being there means reach a point and that's game over. You can always be more there. So better take it like that, like I'll never be there. So the nature of the potential that we are given is endless, and we have a commitment to that call. And the nature of the commitment is I want to commit myself to on a daily basis, trying to put, nowadays you don't use F5 anymore, right, in the computer? Was the update refresh button? I'm too old school, sir. So there was a button in the computer that was like refresh, update. And we are updating all day long our apps in the cell phone, because if not, they don't remain operative.
Yes.
So the same applies to our life and ideas. I mean, if you don't update and upgrade them, they become, as you say, stagnant. Externally, we keep doing all the protocol is there, all the etiquette is there, the do's and don'ts in place, but the living, what's going on inside? No? What's the living current? What's the life wire? How much vibrant the whole thing is? So yeah, I'm very happy to be with you these days, because I mean, I also need this type of immersions. That I keep traveling around the world doesn't mean that I, every single moment, I'm in these types of situations. So I personally look forward to moments of retreat and immersion and the intense focus and openness for disclosure, for bewilderment, for astonishment, for reclaiming the wonder of Krishna consciousness, and keeping ourselves, like showing affection to each other by keeping ourselves in a humble place of wonder forever, and not taking Krishna consciousness for granted, ever. No, never concluding, I know what it is. No? But keeping open the mystery and understanding, that's faith. No? Faith is being patient with mystery. No? Coexisting with mystery, being okay with that, enjoying that that coexistence, and so much will unfold from that. So, anyhow, I could go on, and this is the fault of these two, that they have shown through so many seats, and that's the idea, basically. So, thank you so much, and for being here all with us. And again, as Siva Madhava also said, it's not a three-guy show or a four-guy show. It's all of us participation. So we have some time if someone would like to share. Or what's the plan now? Would you like to share something else?
I would like to turn the conversation. What is the time? Let's just check to be
7:05.
Okay, great. So we're right on for being able to have the second half be a nice respiration. Gopi, and then Ananda.
Really grateful, firstly, just to be here. I feel, just beautiful. I've been listening to Maharaj for some time. It's my first time to be able to meet you, so I'm really grateful to be in your presence. I guess, really, for all three of you, especially with Jai Jagannath and Maharaj, I feel like this reclaiming of identity or idealism, ideals, there's the quest, but then there's also what I'm struggling with is you have that quest in the beginning and you hear the answers, but the practical application according to time and its changes and circumstances I haven't felt In the meeting of those, the powerful questions have maybe answered in words, but maybe not so much in application and living those ideals. And that's where I feel like a lot of my ideals have just gotten crushed. Mm. Of like, yes, the answers are there. Every time I read the Bhagavad Gita, it's there. But I can't find the living, ever-evolving experience of those ideals, and that's where I feel very like I the question would be, yeah, I don't know if I can reclaim the... What does it mean to reclaim my ideals when I can't feel the living example in front of me? Or to show, well, what does it mean to live this X, Y, and Z, this philosophy that is so rich and so layered in how it's applied? And I feel this deep pain and sadness after so many years of practicing of like, I don't know how to reclaim that. I feel really lost because of the disappointment, not from, not have, I have the quest, but I'm trying to find the application of the quest in reality. So I'm wondering if one of, both of you can share your wisdom on that.
Whatever.
I was remembering this, the same verse that I already. This is Parikshit Maharaj's, you know, reporting of his consciousness to the sages on the bank of the Jamuna. So he said, yeah, I'm just going to read it.
Where are you?
This is the first canto, chapter 19, verse number 14. I go to this verse a lot for some sort of solace to these sorts of questions that you're asking. I'll read it first. So the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the controller of both the transcendental and mundane worlds, has graciously overtaken me in the form of a Brahmana's curse. Due to my being too much attached to family life, the Lord, in order to save me, has appeared before me in such a way that only out of fear I will detach myself from the world. The way that I hear this verse or receive this verse is that, yeah, we don't have any of our own personal strength to live out a lot of the ideals, especially these very high, very abstract, very lofty ideals. If I have to live out on our personal strength, forget it. There ain't no question. So the Lord has to come in such a way that he forces out like a vitality in us that allows that to happen. That can come, of course, in the form of song and song, but I want to particularly focus on God, mystery, coming in such a way that forces a vitality out of us so that we can discover a strength that we didn't know that we had. Basically, when we're at home base, we don't realize our potential. They're all just like seeds that remain to be sort of watered, and we don't realize the strength that we have. And then something happens. Like, you've heard these weird stories of like children getting caught underneath the car or something like just super strange, and a mother just lifting the car up and pulling the kid out. Like something that would be normally impossible, but something, a circumstance brought out a vitality that even the mother didn't know she had. That's a crude example, but there are examples of such cases. So Parikshit Maharaj, God has come before me in the form of a curse for a Brahmin boy. And that's forcing out a sort of surrender. He's saying in his humility, out of fear of breaking an attachment, if only out of fear, now I'm able to break it, because God has come in this form and forced out a vitality in me. So I feel like with these sorts of questions, and that's why I was trying to make this point. It was a little subtle, but I was trying to make the point that the process of the journey of return, like leaving home base, we have to kind of be compelled by mystery. That's what I was trying to say. It's something that pushes us and forces out a vitality in us. And I guess what I'm saying to that is that we should be prepared to receive that. Mm-hmm. If that's the question that's like moving in our heart, then we should be prepared to receive that push in the form of something that's unexpected, that's going to oblige like a vitality.
But it almost feels the pain of the family, the home is pushing me out of the home. It's really in the home that I feel the pain and the hurt and the letdown, that I just feel like I don't really identify anymore. I'm being pushed out of something that I do identify with in its Siddhanta, but not in its like embodiment of its quote family. So mm-hmm. And there's a sense of just lostness in it.
Welcome. That's very beautiful. I can tell you one mantra. I've used this as a mantra. It's from the Bible, but I use it kind of as a mantra of consolation because I'm very much in this space of bewilderment and so on. But this Bible statement, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I shall fear no evil. Nahi kalyanakrit kashche durgatam tatagachati, Krishna says also, for those who do the auspicious work, they will not be overcome by evil. That's Prabhupada's translation.
Sincerity is invincible.
Sincerity is invincible. I've used this as a sort of consolation in my own sort of darkness. I feel like I've been pushed on a journey of return. So I'm like very much in that process, and it's painful, it's scary, it's disorienting. And I've sometimes gone to this Bible statement as like a mantra of consolation. You know, I'll just walk and say it like a whisper. Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I shall fear no evil because God walks with me. You know, even in this space of dissolution, God walks with me. And so I have no reason to fear. But I don't understand all the ways in which I'm being called to like manifest what. I don't know. I'm still in that process of morphogenesis, like the forming of a new me. I can only speak from my own process, but being bewildered on it, this is good news. If certainty is the enemy of faith, then this is all good news. But now, how to stay held in that space without like totally disintegrating? So that's my sort of process with that. I don't know.
Yeah, what comes to my mind is that first of all, pleasure to meet you in person, and pleasure to meet you in person. First impression, you being totally vulnerable and open about your inner experience. So that's okay, cool. That's a great introduction. Thank you. And I would say that's the beginning of I don't know the answer, but the healing. Let's put it like that. The fact that one can openly express one's bewilderment in a safe space, that's in itself so crucial for creating eventual healing and whatever needs to be clarified. I was thinking when Jai was mentioning this verse from the Bhagavatam, when it came this other line from the scripture, Atiti Devo Bhavam, which is sometimes interpreted in India more like, okay, you have to treat an uninvited guest as if it's God himself. So it's more like a protocol, social protocol. Someone comes, knocks your door, the neighbor, oh, sit down, please, you want a tea. But the ultimate implication is you have to treat an uninvited guest as if it's God himself. What if the uninvited guest is God himself?
This is just a full circle between the three of us of something that happened.
I was not informed of anything. First time I'm meeting the three of you, I think, right? So that's how the magic starts to happen, right? If we are sincere, safe circle, whatever we need to hear starts to come. Again, Vyaso Beti na Beti. I don't have a clue who you are in one sense. I'm meeting you for the first time, but that's how it happens. That's the implicit trust that both of us have to have, like something will come. So, Atiti Devo Bhavan, ultimately the uninvited guest is God himself, and he always comes uninvited. Krishna is known as a thief, so a thief is pretty uninvited guest, right? He will make you a call. I am going to tomorrow 9 p.m. and take everything from your house. It's like not even when you want to realize where's that? No, so and in that connection, I always like to somehow translate that line with another author's. Simple quote, but it's so powerful for me at least. And she says, Ola Darcy, she says, God comes to you disguised as your life. Mm-hmm. Simple, but try to play that out. God comes to you disguised as your life, as your daily circumstance. That's Krishna coming. Sometimes, where is Krishna? I don't hear the flute. I don't see him. In your face. He's so close that you don't see him. That's the point. Krishna is so close, so intimate,
that we feel that he disappeared sometimes, or we don't know where he is, because he's too close, which is a blessing, but it can be a problem if we don't have the understanding of the level of his proximity. So he comes to us in the form of our life. I mean, we should, that's like a rule of thumb, no? Like in our tradition, whatever is happening, and again, it sounds simple, and it can even be said in a dogmatic way or in a like canceling way, but whatever is happening in your life is for some particular reason. Mm. And that's Krishna coming to your life. Not necessarily how you are reacting to that, but what's coming that clearly may be beyond your control, because of course some things are coming, I know the toilet broke, it's in your control to repair, or your child is below the car, it's in your control to be superwoman and raise the car, as the Janet say. But there are circumstances that I cannot do anything but choose how do I internally relate to that as Krishna coming. So whatever comes to us is not a problem. We are the problem. So, because generally we think in these terms, oh, this problem came and I have to solve it. Mm-hmm. Instead of thinking, this came to solve me as the problem.
Mm. No? Ooh.
Right?
I like that.
Yeah. Because that's reality. Hopefully you like it, because that's how it
is. Like it or not.
That's
so,
best.
So better like it, because it will be like, so, yeah. So it's not so much that there is a problem that I have to solve. No, I need to be solved. I am the problem. And this comes to solve me. So as much as I feel that this is a problem, that speaks of how much I am unwilling to be solved, so to say, by the life circumstance, who is Krishna himself. And maybe it's Krishna himself replying to our previous prayer from the last day, Krishna, please come to my life and give me mercy, and he's coming as your life. And when that comes, we start to pray to Krishna again, Krishna, please protect me and give me mercy. And he says, that was my mercy, and you are praying to counteract my previous mercy. Doesn't work like that.
Dear Lord, please give me a mercy I can understand.
I'm dumb. Yeah. You are clear.
Yeah. Yeah, at least from that place, right? Mm-hmm. I know you're present. I know you are always present. You love me unconditionally. Everything is okay from your side. But I cannot see it. I cannot feel it. And as we say the other day, no? Krishna is omnipresent. God is omnipresent. But sometimes I don't feel him. So if someone is omnipresent and I don't feel him, it means I'm omniabsent. Right? I'm hyper-distracted. So I need presence. I need to be blessed with the gift of presence and appreciate whatever is coming us. And sometimes, again, as much as we can have to do our part, being in places and situations and circles like this is also very powerful. Just the fact that you can present your case, so to say, and it's received and it's honored and it's empathized with, and you are not alone in that journey, because that's one of the most important things we need to be reminded. It's not just only you going through that in the whole planet Earth, because all of us tend to go to that place. And we can self-isolate ourselves in our bubble and zoom in the situation. We lose sight of the bigger picture. And it's all only us going through that. That's super alienating. And that creates a sense of existential dread that is the exact opposite of what reality is about, which is everything is connected already. Krishna's in the center. You know, the whole hierarchy. Everything is complete, perfect. Everything is interconnected. Love. Krishna loves you fully already. But we lose sight of that, and tragedy comes. So, yeah, that will be our answer and my answer and Jai's. But, and I appreciate that we are not trying to give you any closure. No? Like we are not like, okay, this is the actual solution to your problem. In practical terms, this, and that's over. No, instead of like, be okay with mystery, now welcome bewilderment, learn to honor what happens in the liminal space outside of the comfort zone. See that as Krishna's mercy taking you outside of the familiar, because outside of the familiar is when you will have your deepest epiphanies in life. You will have a very deep epiphany in the total familiar comfort zone. Nothing too exciting will happen there. Mm-hmm. We need to be gently pushed. and trusting the pushing, no? Trusting. Gopritui varanam, as we will talk tomorrow. That's the essence of Saranagati and surrender, which is Krishna is maintaining me. Krishna is maintaining. That doesn't mean only at the end of the month I will have bread on my plate. That's a very superficial understanding. That's included in the equation. But
thank you.
Yeah. Prashanam is ready. Devamada makes it. It's there. But on deeper levels, Krishna maintaining me in all these situations. If this situation is coming, it's Him. It's coming from Him to maintain me, to nourish me, to get me closer. It's His love. It's His love. And sometimes we don't get love. We don't understand love. we all have over-idealized love in a very limited way. So when real love knocks our door, we're just terrified, running for Krishna, for praying for, again, mercy. Mm-hmm. That was my love, Krishna saying. No, like even the gopis in Rasa Lila are asking Krishna, like, why you disappear from Rasa Lila? He said, because I love you. And they're like, oh. He said, yeah, I love you. So since I love you, I want to give you the best. And the best is that your love increases. And I knew that by separation, your love will increase. And that's why I disappear, because I love you. Mm-hmm. They were like, wow, oh, charming guy. Charming. Yeah, beautiful. But my point is, sometimes we may wonder, no, why? But we have to have this underlying trust of, this is Krishna coming to me, this is Krishna maintaining me, and if I remain, I trust that if I remain open enough for the disclosure in the midst of bewilderment, I will receive what I need. And I can assure you, I mean, I cannot just but talk about my own experience, and I've gone through a few forced
exodus.
Forced exile. What you were going to say?
No, I said exodai, but
yeah, what?
That's really a word.
No, I was just speculating.
Octopus.
Exile. Exodus.
Octopus. Why not? That's good. So yeah, my point is that. That's part of this type of retreats also, just for you to know.
They'll make fun of you.
So yeah, I mean, going through those exiles, I can always guarantee you 108%, every time you are kicked out of that comfort zone and thrown into the unknown, if one is remains for grace relatively open, trusting something is happening here, at the end of the day you are receiving the most powerful and deep teachings and impressions and foundation and shelter and confirmations. It may take some time, and that period of time is also patience, is a way of showing our faith. No? Mm-hmm. Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta will say that. When we show impatience, yeah, in front of the arrangements of the Lord, we are showing that we don't have faith, basically, mm-hmm. he's saying. No? So showing faith means He's making arrangements. I'm absolutely bewildered, have no clue what's going on, but I'm patient. I'm patient doesn't mean just waiting, but waiting while trusting. Mm. No, not just waiting neurotic and like, I'm being patient. But I'm waiting, I'm trusting that something is unfolding, and I'm trusting that unfolding, and the trust will guide the way. So. I have hope. It's already happening. Did Ma have something to say or something?
Oh, no, no. Do you feel complete there?
Mm-hmm. I'm just appreciating that baseball analogy. Because
he used to be a catcher.
That's true. No, but just in extending it in my mind, like there's a big risk going around the bases because you can get thrown out. Mm-hmm. And also, like, there's a risk being at home, especially if you're standing at the plate, because then you got a 98-mile-per-hour object like flying at you, and I begin to think then like any type of hit, like that ball's getting thrown at you, and any type of hit is our question that then forces us to traverse the bases, and sometimes it's just a bunt and I gotta like really run hard. Sometimes it's a big hit because it's a really big question, and it's kind of like I get guided around the bases. But anytime I ask that question, the risk of being thrown out is there. However, like, the risk also of just not hitting, you still get walked. Mm-hmm. Like, you're still going to get, even if you don't hit the ball, you'll still get thrown out there. Mm-hmm. So I was really appreciating that analogy there, because it's, and then the multiple innings, like my mind took
off. Anything I said after that was blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, yeah.
I got involved, like, yeah, and I'm going to do this and make that point.
Yeah. All the multiple innings that one goes through also. So, And just appreciating this point of God shows up to us as our life. And how... really, that on one hand, the simplicity of being present to that, how real of an experience that becomes. Because oftentimes, when I think of like reclaiming my ideals, it's often this. I just remember when I first started chanting, and the devotee that I met was like, "Yeah, it's kind of like an LSD trip. Like you'll get this like psychedelic experience kind of thing." And so that was initially like, "Oh, like I want to alter my state of consciousness." And sometimes the goal, or even like sitting down to pray or sitting down to any type of ceremony, the goal is like some altered experience where it's just very like loud and in your face. But actually, like the profundity of being present to the fact that life is happening, and in whatever that state that I'm in, how important and prescient and needed and powerful it actually already is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We were talking the other day with Bhakti Rasa and Sumati in North Carolina. We did for Ekadasi some special kirtan, like for 5 hours, and in the middle of the forest and some fire. Mm-hmm. So we crafted some sacred space, so to say, but the conclusion was we are crafting this sacred space to be reminded that every space is sacred. But unless we do that crafting, we lose awareness. So we need to force some crafting, so to say, of space of presence. That's my point. In that sacred space, your presence is more clearly invited to enter the space, and then you have that glimpse of, oh, everything is safe, everything is there if I am there again. So I just thought about that point, that sometimes we like this retreat is some form of crafting sacred space and sacred time to be present in a certain way, but hopefully the fruit in returning home is every space and every time is actually sacred. I may need to craft that quite often to remind myself, but at least keep that idea. All space, all time is sacred as long as I learn to be present. The Bhagavatam will call it Shakshitva, or witnesshood. Not like entering to that space of pure contemplation without projecting bias and biases and assumptions and filtering reality with my own samskars, but just allowing reality to be. Yeah. Some comment on that. Yeah. Thank you.
This one, Maharaj was.
Nice to see you again.
About the idea that God is appearing to us in questions and forcing us to embark on a journey, or like coming to us in the form of discomfort that propels us outside of our comfort zone. And sometimes he's knocking on our door that way. I came up with this analogy of dogs often, like, they're begging for chocolate ice cream from their owner, and
that's specific.
You know, like okay, no, dogs beg, and chocolate is not good for dogs, it's poison, so they'll die if they have it, and so the dog is thinking, oh, my owner doesn't love me, he's not giving me what I want, but actually he's protecting him. And then on the converse, dogs hate, if you've ever tried to give a dog medicine, it's like, it's so horrible. And they'll like bite you, and but actually it's the owner's love. It's preventing poison and administering medicine. But in both times, the dog doesn't have the consciousness to understand what's actually this is actually love.
Yeah.
So not a perfect articulation of that, but that's what comes to mind.
Yeah.
If there's time, I want to also ask her a question. So I have a friend who's very, very deep, but also does not know peace and has been in constant suffering, gone through a lot of trauma. And at a certain point in my, you know, in knowing him, he was, he started to pray to, like, the substance or the personification of discomfort. Like, to not be in conflict with discomfort, to respect discomfort as a teacher. And now, that was a few months ago, now he's at a different place where he just really wants healing and peace. And I'm also at the place where I've been really just desiring healing and peace after not really knowing so for, since childhood, been through a lot of burning in Rahu, Saturn, and but now, because of, you know, knowledge of the Bhagavatam and know, and hearing that, you know, life is tapasya, and to secure a comfortable position in this material world is like having a nice jail cell. So I'm in conflict about the value of healing and health, even like sattva guna. Like, there are things in my life that are pushing me towards like health and healing, and I'm desiring that, but then there's also like
the Bhagavatam says being unhealthy.
Right, exactly. Life is about like fire, you know, the fire.
Can I clarify something regarding what I said? Mm-hmm. Just because it may have made seem that I'm just like talking about, okay, fire and outside of the comfort zone and discomfort, and you have to love that. Unless you do that, you are wrong. But I'm not saying that. We were just making some points on some side of the scale, but also again, Yuktahara Viharasya, Yukta, just as Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, everything is to be done in a balanced way. And what's balanced for one person is not the same thing that for other person, or even for the same person in different stages. So it's there's not like one way of doing it, but I'm not against healing or paying attention to your health. I mean, I do that myself, but there's a way to do that in a balanced way that is not just my absolute objective and becomes a distraction for something else, or an evasive mechanism to not work on other forms of healing that I also need. But just to make clear that I personally am not the type of person or sannyasi who will be like, it's all bad, reject, bad, tapasya, fire, suffering. Like masochist or something, right? No, I mean, there's a need of that also, right? I mean, chaos and order, as we were talking. No, too much order suffocated. Too much chaos is too much also. I mean, it's a nightmare. So enough to keep ourselves challenged in a healthy way on a daily basis. And again, there are periods in life where we will need less disruption and more like, okay, well, as you will say, I think Narakans or something, like, I will take some chips and sit for a while and like, give me a break for a moment. And sometimes you will be thrown into the fire with chips included. So it's toasted.
You want cheese on
that?
Toasted chips with you.
toasted chips, you will have that.
A little bit of cheese.
Yeah.
Extra barbecue cheese.
But yeah, I just want to make that.
The imagery was very rich in
what to do? Udipana is Udipana. Trigger. I just want to clarify that. Of course, you guys say something, but just to make that point clear that we are not here about, okay, just fire, pure fire, and it's all about that. But you have to practice. Krishna says, so sukham kartum in the Gita. You have to practice bhakti with happiness and joy. Even in the context of difficulty, there has to be a certain balance that keeps you happy and grateful and having some sense of shelter, even when everything else is shattering. But you have to practice from a place that there is enough balance, and that's sattva, no? That learn to balance whatever situation you're in. Yeah, anyhow, you continue, please. Your mother.
Evan, I relate to you a lot this time we've spent together. I sense in you this need for everything to be integrated. If Krishna's real, he's got to be everywhere. That's the implication. And in your question, there's this implied cultural idea that Krishna somehow isn't in material comfort and he is in torture and pain. Tapo divyam. And he says even... Tapo me hridayam shakshat. Mm-hmm. Like, my heart is that burning you're experiencing. So these things are there. And in my own walk, what I've experienced is that if I can find some sense of my lack of awareness in Krishna in my material dysfunction, how my material dysfunction is a symptom of my lack of awareness of Krishna, then I'm able to restore that function materially because I'm inspired to go find out what Krishna wants to show me there. And my first attempt at the Grihastha ashram, I didn't really understand how serving one person was going to allow me to serve the person. And then in my second attempt, I very clearly have this recognition that if I say ahoitiki apratiyata for adokshaga, for Krishna, but I can't even do it for the one person who's in front of me every day, if I can't even offer ahoitiki apratiyata to her, how can I pretend or dare say that my ideal is to one day offer it to him? And that's allowed me to renew my relationship to sattva life in the context of Grihastha ashram and feel very excited every day that I show up, even though I don't want to for whatever reason, for my wife as a husband, as I've understood it means to be good. At the very least, I feel some sense of depositing into my bank account the potential, the maturity, the strength to show up for Krishna that way one day, to show up for Guru that way one day. And in my physical health, in my personal emotional health, I've found similar connections between my relationship with Krishna and the dysfunction in my life. And that gets me excited to dig in there. The word wonder has come up a lot, and Kavi Karnapur, he says, rasa sar chamatkar. The essence of rasa, taste, joy, is wonder. So my one of my mantras for myself has been, follow your wonder, follow my wonder. Wherever I feel some inspiration, I'm old enough in Krishna consciousness to trust Krishna's over there somewhere. I'm going to go find him. And that, then that mood of inquiry is there. I don't know how he's in marriage because it's a deep, dark well. But he must be in marriage also. So let me go find out. And now you can't make me shut up about talking about it. Right? I constantly discuss it because it's so exciting to me. And I also know how much it is causing burning, unnecessary pain in other people's lives that they're not aware of that. And similar potency and power is waiting in the dysfunction in your life. That's my own experience and also faith for someone like you who has that maturity already.
What's ahoitiki?
There's a verse in the beginning of the Bhagavatam where Suta Goswami summarizes everything from the questions of the sages, and this verse is like the seed of the whole rest of the Bhagavatam in some sense. And ahoitiki and apratiyata. Ahoitiki means unmotivated, and then apratiyata means uninterrupted. So a constant and selfless sense of service to adokshaja or the supreme transcendence, that's what will bring supracidity, supreme satisfaction to the living entity. because the sages just ask, it's Kali Yuga, everyone's going to be miserable and upset, what do we do? And Suta Goswami in one verse lays it out. And then the rest of his offering of the Bhagavatam is in some sense a commentary on that verse.
This is 1.26.
1.26, yes.
I wanted to say also that I was reminded of the when Raghunath Das was just Raghunath Das and not Das Goswami. Mm-hmm. So he was always trying to escape the house, creating big disturbance. So he got one chance to finally meet Mahaprabhu. So Mahaprabhu gave him a big chastisement that you're trying to practice monkey vairagya. Because mm-hmm. the monkeys also are renounced. They walk around naked and eat only a few things. But all the time thinking about sex. And of course they show.
Think and do.
Yeah. So he said it's monkey vairagya. Then he has this one verse in the course of his chastisement. Antare kare nishtha bahya loke vyavahar. He says, inside you keep your faith, but you know your faith should be fixed. But outside you behave like everyone else, so that no one can detect what's going on inside. Mm. And it's always like a very practical instruction for most of us that are involved in the world in some way, shape, or form. It's like I feel like there's a way that you can even do things that are, now this is my own personal purpose, so you can take this or leave this. What I first said was clearly shastric. What I'm about to say is take it or leave it. But there's a sense that sometimes you even find yourself engaged in things that are not aligned with your ideals, because of the force of destiny. You know, you have a body, your prarabdha karma is unfolding in a certain way, and you find yourself in spaces just by the force of destiny. What is that? Jata shradama katasu nivina sarvakarma suvita dukatma kamka. Parityage api anishwara. Anishwara, this verse is, you've got faith, you kind of concluded that all material activities is ultimately empty. That is there. You know at least for suffering. You try to give it up completely and you can't give it up. Sense gratification. Anishwara means like you're not in control. It kind of speaks to the force of destiny. Like you ever seen Ganga River, if you go up to the Himalayan mountains, the Ganga River is so fast they have chains. So you can get inside, otherwise the river will take you. Right? You've been? Oh, that happened to someone.
Well,
you almost died.
Yeah. we crossed the Ganga at a rapids up in
right,
like 13,000
right in the mouth. It was
like arm in arm, chained, like rushing water up to our thighs. The guides didn't want to take us, but we were like, please.
Wow.
Oh my gosh.
And we did it. We're here still.
So like that, Anishwara, you just like, by the force and circumstance, you find yourself. But inside your faith may be like, this is not very good, but that is very good. You know, this is not my ideal space. I will enjoy it. Like that, I feel like that happens to us psychologically. I will enjoy this. It's by destiny's arrangement. You know, my karma is fructifying in a particular way. I will enjoy this, but this is not my ideal. My ideal is elsewhere. You know, antara kare nishtha bahya loka. Yeah, I'm connecting the two verses from Bhagavatam, this statement. Because the rest of the verse says, tato bachatamam pritta shraddha lur dhrita nishtaya. You remember this verse?
Beda dukatmakam. Yeah, I forget the one line. But one repents.
One repents. That he says, Krishna says the person should continue his bhajan with faith and determination. And even though he is sometimes engaged with, you know, the senses, sense objects. I was like, only sometimes? What do you mean, like sometimes every day, sometimes? Sometimes during each day. Even though he repents inside. And I think Sri Vishnu has some comment like he enjoys while criticizing. This may not be 100% my ideal. So I feel like that's also very practical, you know? I'm a helpless jiva. I'm definitely under the force of destiny. But I will not betray my faith. Even I cannot live my faith right now. For whatever reasons, I cannot live my faith. Sometimes that happens to devotees. You cannot live your faith. But I will not betray my faith. That is very good. You know, this is one of my, just as a sidebar, it's one of my issues with the Gaudiya Sanghas. Like how they always talk smack about each other.
And Govardhan, you can see it a lot. They always talk smack. If you go to any kata, anywhere you go, someone is talking about how the other one is not bona fide. It's a very common thing. So I found this one verse where Narada is speaking to Vasudeva in the 11th canto. And he says, anyone who hears, anyone who chants, anyone who remembers, or anyone who can just say, this is very good. They themselves cannot do it for whatever reasons, but they can say, this is very good. And they'll get so much benefit. So I feel like that I get stuck in that space sometimes where I'm, by destiny, I'm stuck in some space. And I will enjoy the space also. Mm-hmm. But my ideal, I will not betray that.
Could you differentiate a little bit? Because sometimes I feel like I can say that one's pretty strong, that not living is a type of betrayal. Mm-hmm. Can you just maybe highlight that a little bit more? Because like, sometimes that's a thread. But if I'm not living, I'm betraying it.
Yeah, I feel like betrayal happens. I assume that betrayal is something internal, that you want to betray someone. And there's also where you make an action that appears like betrayal. Right? You do some action out of ignorance or out of even thinking it would be good, and the person receives it as betrayal. Then you try to reconcile, no, that wasn't my intention. But, and then there's someone trying to actually betray, and they betray it. So here what I'm saying is about that inner thing. I'm not living out the ideal, not because I'm against the inner thing, but I feel helpless. I'm under the force of destiny, but I'll not betray my faith inside. I feel this is very good. Whereas, I'm not abandoning that inside. But somehow by destiny, I find myself. So there's so many verses like this in Bhagavatam. I just gave the two, the main verse that I know.
The difference between a demon and a monster. Mm. We have this language in our community.
Really?
Yeah. Demon.
Right.
We're all demons because we like potato chips. What's that?
I feel like it's coming to the secular world now. Like, Trump is a demon.
Yeah. Or they say they're demonizing us. Okay. Also, like, so there's this word demon that it's of course prominent in our community. And we have this way of thinking, oh, I'm a demon because I did something I wasn't supposed to. I betrayed my ideal. But Jai, this is from Uddhava Gita, right? The 11th canto, that verse. So this verse is pointing to, in Western literature, what is couched as monsters. There's a difference between the monsters and the demons. Frankenstein is a monster because he doesn't want to be a bad guy. He doesn't want to create problems. But there's also some force of his nature that makes him step on people's toes, makes him awkward. And the demons are like Dracula, actively aware of the bad that they're causing in other people's lives and trying to make it. So, and to your point, how much am I actively trying to create problems for myself and others? And how much is it just the force of my awkwardness from previous experiences and past lives and my circumstance right now that I find myself in because I'm minute and the influence is too strong. Yeah. And I would hope most of us would count ourselves on the side of the monsters.
Mm-hmm. There's a purport from Srila Prabhupada in Bhagavad Gita, chapter 3, like 9:18, I forget, somewhere around there. But he starts his purport by saying, even if one cannot fulfill the regular principles, still, one should not resent their existence.
Yeah.
And so when
that's
I think
3:31.
What is it?
3:31.
Yeah. So when I think of the difference between betrayal and not living up to something, it's this sense of like internal disposition. Like if I start to come across the line where I start to, you know, like resent or criticize a principle,
deny it,
philosophize it away. Then I know that's like I'm crossing a line that I don't want to or don't need to cross. Rather, like this is the ideal. I don't have to take it off the altar. I don't have to close the curtains even. I can still like leave the curtains open, keep that ideal on the altar, and honor that space.
Nice. Yeah. And one thing I would say in our particular tradition is that we have such a high ideal. That has lots of potential neuroses because it's so high and that I can constantly remind myself that I'm not there. But again, the ideal is ever evolving. So in one sense, you will never be there. For me, that's a good way to heal the neurosis. It's not that I'm not there. And when I'm there, okay, I'm there now. No, I've seen devotees doing that. Like, I have not been initiated for 13 years, but now I'm initiated. Right? Like, no, now you initiated the process of initiation. But no, you feel like, okay, now I'm there. Before that, you were just weeping on yourself. I'm not there. And now I've become proud and I'm there. It's, both of them were wrong. So yeah, the ideal is so high that I will say we have to, I mean, not to be lazy and not to be complacent and not to betray ourselves. That's the worst type of betrayal. But also to be, how to say, realistic and make the whole thing sustainable, because if you want just to be in Bhava Bhakti next weekend, that won't work probably. So you have to, as you say, allow certain forces and certain winds and even remain aware of Krishna in those moments. I mean, there is a place to, if there comes some benefit or some material in enjoyment, if you want to call it like that. But if you include Krishna in the picture somehow or other, I mean, that's the main thing, actually, right? So it's not so much which wave is coming or not, but how you are keeping that presence. Smarta vyasata tam vishnur vishmanta. Now, all the rules and regulations in the scripture are just to, for this thing, like, try to keep Krishna present in your life somehow or other. So that's for me a very important verse. That's where I go to, okay, this is the essence of everything.
What you were both saying about enjoyment reminded me of the first class that I was attending here about Dhruva Maharaj when he gets the kingdom. Mm-hmm. And basically the question is, what does he do with it? And enjoy it. The answer is enjoy it.
Yeah. Paradoxically.
Jiva Goswami speaks about Krama Mukti also, no? People that want the ultimate Mukti. But also they want like a tour before that. A clan tour, and they go through different layers and planet, heavenly planets and different experiences. But they know, I want that ultimate goal, but I like to have a little...
Check out Siddha Loka.
Yeah.
Make some stops along.
Hang out with the mystics a little bit here and there. And
why is it so demonized then?
That's a good question.
You're a Naya. You're wanting too much, or, you know, you shouldn't live that way. You should live like an ascetic. You should not want things, you should not keep things, you should not.
You should ask that question to those who tell you those things. Because each one may have a different unresolved layer that makes them say those things with any bad intention, but maybe just for immature understanding or otherworldly orientation to Krishna Bhakti, like this is all about leaving this place, like we were talking these days, because matter is bad. So when you have that root misreading, everything becomes like evacuation plan for the afterlife. And that's not Bhakti. Bhakti is not an evacuation plan for the afterlife. It's meet Krishna here and now. Be present to the miracle of existence right here. If you are not doing that now, you won't be reaching there at any moment.
My advent into the movement 3 years ago was actually, ironically, the study of quantum physics. Realizing that the God particle was the base of every single bit of matter, molecule, and it hit me like a ton of bricks. Like, God is everywhere. Everything has God's energy. And, oh, God's not dead. Oh, God's not dead. And it was just such a revelation for me. And then I lost my husband, and then I lost my job, and then I lost my house, and I lost everything.
Yay, Krishna
consciousness. It's
amazing. And then I realized that I gained everything in the process. And then I had a car accident, and then I lost my business, and I lost my relationship, and now here I am again. And, like, it's another rebirth, and it's another whole cycle of God. I was just talking to Ujwal about this, about how you think that these things externally, if someone's watching me, that all these bad things are always happening to you, and oh, how many car accidents have you been in, and all of these things that have happened, and da-da-da-da-da, and all this must be, wow. But actually, every single occurrence, every single painful experience was a teacher, and it continues to do so long as I'm able to have the sobriety to look back on it and say, what did I learn from that? What can I continue to learn from that? My kids are all grown and gone. Did I raise them for nothing?
they're gone. I don't have, my daughter sees me sometimes. And I realize it's Krishna's arrangement that I only get to see her sometimes. Now it won't be as painful when it really turns out to be that she's going to go off and get married and be gone forever. Ouch. Mm. But also I don't live near my other kids and I live near my grandson. And I experienced something very painful recently, physically painful. Drove myself into it, actually. Almost killing myself because of self-hatred and self-loathing.
It's amazing you reference God as dead. That quote, after realizing God is everywhere.
Yeah.
Because that oft-quoted passage from Nietzsche, mm-hmm. he's saying that in a marketplace. Mm-hmm. And his point is that because we've reduced existence to my sense enjoyment, mm-hmm. and the marketplace mm-hmm. is the temple of that idea, mm-hmm. that I can go and I can get what I want from whatever vendor and stimulate my senses and therefore be happy, now I don't need God. So God has died not because he's not somewhere or everywhere, but because my utility for God has been taken away, the marketplace, Amazon.
New God. We have created a new God.
Exactly. The deity of consumption and my enjoyment. And to recognize that God is everywhere is the beginning of the antidote. Because I don't, if he's everywhere, I don't need any particular thing. The marketplace's allurement is softened by that. And I can start to come back to recognizing whatever circumstance I've been put into, the implication is that it must be for my seva. On some level, it must be for my service, because my attempt at serving myself, it wasn't working. And the marketplace, the whole paradigm and the deification of that idea, so many minds and so much energy and so much time put into it, it's failed. It didn't work. And it allows us to return to the original ethic of the soul as a servant. That's Nietzsche's saying the same thing in that essay. It's so often misquoted and misappropriated.
And then Nietzsche will say, if God will come to me as a dancer, I will immediately surrender to you. That's a full circle.
Isn't life a dance?
Yeah.
That's why God must be. Nietzsche picked up on that. Yeah. Ethan.
So I've been pondering this throughout this whole discussion. I'm fairly new to bhakti and the movement, but feel very deeply pulled in, like from the, like immediately. And you know, this idea of like reclaiming ideals is a little bit wonky for me, because I don't even know if I know what ideals there are to claim to begin with. You know, I went through this really intense honeymoon phase. You know, I honestly felt like I was just so drunk in love with Krishna for the last 2 years, and I was like, man, but you know, and I think about honeymoon phases in relationship, right? They always peter out, and then we're always trying to get back to the honeymoon. How do I like have that like passion again, that spark, that flame, you know? And so it feels almost like, I don't know if like idealizing the honeymoon phase is the right move, but like I guess my question is somewhere along the lines, like, how do I know what ideals to even install for me to begin, you know, like aiming for or to like be inspired and motivated by, you know? Like, I know there's regulative principles and, you know, the what my sangha and like teachers have like, you know, told me, but how do I decide for myself what my own bhakti ideals are, you know, in Krishna consciousness, that's also aligned with, you know, the regulative principles of the scriptures, the things, you know, that are proven to bring us closer to the Supreme. So that's sort of what I've been pondering. I'd love to hear your reflections on that.
It's beautiful that you articulate it that way, because that's what everyone else is wondering also. Just encumbered by their idea that they had it sometime previously.
I would tell people that they should only take as many steps as the steps that they take in Krishna consciousness should be proportionate to the enlightenment they genuinely feel from the topics that they're hearing. In other words, because especially when you come into like a space like this and you start to become like your people, then it's like the force of cultural acceptance can cause you to embrace something that doesn't feel true for you yet. Or you haven't had the questions that will allow you to embrace that as fully true. And when you're in a space like this, the tendency will be to betray yourself in that sense. And I would tell people sometimes like this, the steps you take in Krishna consciousness should be proportionate. The level of inquiry you have, of course, and the actual enlightenment you're getting from that, that's causing you to embrace that. And then again, then you can enter the cycle where you have to renew it or refresh, it goes. But I don't know, I don't know. That's what comes up immediately.
I'll share something in the morning, maybe you can close us out. It's coming to 8 o'clock and bellies, and et cetera. So this seems like a very sweet place to close for the evening also. I have a saying that I keep with me. Some people don't like it, but I say better half burnt than half baked. You can fix something half burnt, but something half baked, there's never, it's always just going to be gluggy inside. No one wants it. You can scrape off the burnt part.
Half burnt.
You're obviously not much of a baker. So,
the mood is that there's leaving it all on the field, so to speak. There's this very pensive way that postmodernism causes us all to exist. Very fearful mood, because the whole idea of postmodernism is that there is no truth. So you think you found the truth. That's so cute. Another one who thought they found the truth. I've seen that New York Times article that many of you have probably seen of somebody who came to the devotees and then decided to leave the devotees. It's circulating. If you haven't seen it, you'll see it soon. Some devotee will share it with you. And many people are like, why did the New York Times put this article out? Because nothing big seemed to happen. No rape, no children died, no money stolen, like the usual big stuff that would get New York Times exposure for religion, cheating somebody. This was a very pedestrian narrative of this girl just like subtly feeling emotionally abused at the end of her time in the ashram. But that's the degree that the postmodern world has taken things. That's all that need be said for everybody's sense of truth being a lie to be triggered. Just see, another one bites the dust, another failed experiment in pursuing something noble. So my own like antidote to that is to just go for it. And you're gonna mess up. You're gonna miss the mark. And you will be misled on certain levels, either subtly or actively. And if you really trust yourself, you'll recover and then some. And you'll be able to help others. Like I notice in our own Sangha now, the people that are coming today are asking questions that it took me 6 years to ask. And they're asking them in 6 months. And not just one or two, like as a collective, you know, as a layer of the community. They all are on that space because of the processed trauma that others of us have done. And now we're offering back, as Maharaj has said before, we're offering it back as wisdom. And so now you get to go create your own trauma. And you'll go through your own process.
There's no more.
More is coming. Yeah, top the trip to hell.
Please more.
It's a muscle, you know. It's an appetite we're building digestive energy for. Yeah. And so just don't be apprehensive. Don't hold back in the name of staving off some level of suffering. It will come. Whatever suffering you're meant to feel and experience, it will find its way to you. The question is, when it does, will you have the fortitude and faith to appreciate this is also a love tap? This is also a touch of grace. As much as it may burn right now, it will eventually become sweet. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita, there's many different analogies of what prema, love, tastes like. One is as poison, but my favorite is as molten
sugar.
Date sugar, date gore, tapta, tripta, charvana, that it's so sweet. Oh, it's like melted sugar, you know, it's so irresistible, but it also burns. Tapta, it burns, but I can't stop taking it because it's so sweet. And that fitness, that's what we're praying to receive. That's love. And so every touch you feel of that, that's actually, you're there with the truth. The moment that it feels both awkward and inspiring, that's the truth. So don't avoid those moments and don't try to calculate your way out of them.
rather seek them out.
Thank you. It reminds me of the prayers of Queen Kunti.
Yeah.
In Srimad Bhagavatam.
Yeah.
Please send me more so I can remember you.
Because that's where I see you.
Yeah,
her,
I will never see you.
It's not necessary to request. But Kunti's showing us.
Yeah.
I heard that Jagannath for the every I'll time I quote that verse, it's like, I will never see
I will recite, no problem.
But it's more
from the heart.
That's
more
she said it. It's beautiful.
We are ready to conclude, Devamala?
I think if you want to
say... Maharaj, you were ready to conclude?
Yeah, a few last words and then we'll wrap up.
Little bow on things?
I mean, what both of you say was right to the point. I couldn't have put that better. I'm thinking, I really appreciate as simple as it is what Devamala said, like, know that you will make mistakes and don't conceive spirituality as a journey of perfection.
Mm.
Because Krishna already loves you unconditionally. Mm-hmm. No, I mean, that's for me a very foundational, important point that has so many ramifications. When you know God already loves you and accepts it, you're just like, oh, okay, I don't have to enter into the perfectionist neurosis, so he likes me at some point. Mm-hmm. No, because unconsciously, many of us are performing, as we were talking the other day with Ujjwal, you just practice Krishna consciousness from a performative place and a transformative place. And many of us are in unconsciously performative, trying to perform, trying to deserve, trying to add points and check boxes. So we are good boys and good girls, and Krishna likes us someday. But actually, he already accepted you fully and loves you unconditionally. So that creates a whole different orientation to approach him from a place that you already accepted me. You are not demanding perfection from me. That's actual perfection. Perfection doesn't demand perfection, but perfection includes imperfection.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm really perfect, I will include and integrate your imperfections and redeem it. And instead of, unless you are perfect, you cannot approach me the perfect one. That's not perfect. Real perfection must include imperfection. And that's what Krishna does, by loving us unconditionally, without expecting anything in return. His love is unconditional. And that's the seed inspiration for us to offer unconditional love back to him. So that will be one point that for me is important, to not go into this performative neurosis that I have to be perfect, and if I fail, what will happen? And Krishna may be angry, he will reject me, and I will... Blah, 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 blah. It's not happening, just in case. No, as I like to frame it, and it may sound a little bit even bold, but I like to tell the devotees, you are already saved, technically speaking. Krishna says that in the Gita over and over again. Name bhakta pranashati, neha vikrama nashati. My devotee never perishes. Whatever advancement you make, you will never get lost. Yogakshemam bahamyaham, whatever you have, I preserve it. Unless you become a total monster attacking bhakti and hating, which it doesn't feel, you are demon, sorry, monster is something else. We are learning, we are reframing our lingo here, so thank you. So, you're already saved. You're already doing what you want to do for eternity, which is bhakti. So, you're already doing what you want to do for eternity. You have nowhere else to go. You just need to go deeper into that. And there's no end to how deeper you can go. So, whatever you are doing now, going deeper into bhakti, is what you will be doing in Golok Vrindavan. Continue to go deeper into bhakti. So how much there is a difference there? You follow? So from that place... For me, it's way more realistic and human to practice instead of have to be perfect, I have to follow everything without fail. I mean, of course, we want to do things nicely, but also, let's be realistic, we will fail. But we have to learn from those failures. And actually, as Richard Rohr, friend, mentor of mine, he will say, generally we grow more by doing it wrong than by doing it right. Sometimes you do it right and you're like, okay, I'm doing right. I deserve, I belong, I fit in. And you do it wrong, it's a humbling opportunity to pray and repent and learn and grow. So don't force yourself to make mistakes, but be completely sure you will make them, but be completely sure those will be portals to transformation and And if that happens, how much you can call that mistakes at the end of the day. So that, and one last thing regarding the honeymoon period you were referring to, and of course all of us have our honeymoon period. And I personally will say, just be careful of not becoming like addicted to toxic nostalgia, like looking back and, oh, I would like that to be, like, I remember once in Argentina, I'm from there, and one god sister of mine at the time, like maybe 10 years ago or more, she told me, Maharaj, I would like so much to go back and experience what I experienced the first day I joined the temple. And I was like, no. No. I mean, my no was not from a place that it was horrible. It was from a place that it was beautiful. And because it's beautiful, I'm honoring that moment in the way that now it has to appear in an upgraded version. Mm-hmm. You know? That's my way of honoring the beautiful honeymoon past. You know? So it, like in a couple, I mean, you have your honeymoon and certain experiences that I cannot talk too much about them as sannyasis. I have no experience of that. But the point is, eventually you may have kids and house and job, and it's other stage of work and commitment and responsibility. But in its own way, that's the magic, and that's the grounding, and that's the love to each other. In one sense, even more deeper than probably in the teenager, adolescence, honeymoon period. Not to dismiss that, but just that sets the ground for everything else. So I will say the same. In Krishna consciousness, let's not be nostalgic about, I experienced Krishna in this way and the holy name in this way, and now it's happening differently. Yeah, that's what's supposed to happen. It has to be different. No, it's not just trying to bring back the experience, over-idealizing the past, that the grass seems always greener on the other side of the fence, and but remaining open to new versions of how Krishna is approaching us again. Even if they sound like unsettling, or maybe they are how to say, disrupting our attachment to experience Krishna a certain way. And that can be so. I remember reading this book on the dark night of the soul by this psychologist. What's his name? Some of you wrote it.
Gerald Mayes.
Yeah, thank you. He will say this great thing that I included in Radical Personalism, that he will say that many times we feel God disappeared from my life. I'm not feeling Krishna. He's not there. I'm not feeling. And he's saying, actually he's getting closer, but since you are so attached to experiencing him in a certain way, he's not coming from that box. He's closer, actually, but you keep looking to him appearing in a predictable way you are attached to, and you feel he disappeared. But he's getting closer. But you are attached to a nostalgic past version of how you used to taste your relationship with God. And that's not happening anymore. Now it's getting better, but you are not perceiving that as better because you are too much attached to that particular version. So I think it's important that we keep that clear in mind, because again, Krishna is always trying to get closer. So we try to put him in a box. Every time he gets closer, we feel he's disappearing more and more. Because he's getting closer, and I want him to keep straight, clean one, single box, controllable, predictable, but that's not Krishna. Again, he's a great adventurer, so don't try to put Krishna in a box. As it were. So, and I'm not saying that to you, it's for all of us, right? Because just to remind ourselves that Krishna is a king of dancers, so he keeps moving. In the altar here, Krishna is not like this, not like, he's like crooked and moving and dancing, so everything about him is like zigzag dynamics. That's how love moves, like a snake, the scriptures say. The other day I was reading the Vishnu Sahasranam, the 1,000 names of God. One name of Vishnu, Krishna, is Biala, which means snake, no? Literally. And generally the explanations come because he moves in a crooked way like a snake. And Rupa Goswami said love moves like a snake. Of course, Krishna is love, so. Like a snake means unpredictable, zigzag, not like straight line. So, welcome to the dance. Sadhu Sangha ki jai. Gaur Premananda ki jai. Vansha kalpataruvya chag, sindhubya chavati tana pranevya vaishnavya namo. Ananta koti vaishnavrinda ki jai. Jai Jagannath Prabhu ki jai. Deva Mahaprabhu ki jai. Gaur Bhaktavrinda ki jai. Gaur Bhaktavrinda ki jai. Gaur Hari.